Hey y'all, I'm Whitney Scarborough, the host of Wits End. Here we are real people asking hard questions. If you think you hear the hum of a fridge or a train in the background, it's because you probably are. We are recording these episodes from the comfort of my home in a small town called LaGrange, Texas.
Today I am joined by the first guy on the podcast who happens to be my husband, Tim. We talk about living a double life between the church and the party scene, a hard wake-up call that led to a major shift, and losing a parent at a young age. Let's dive in. Well, it seems only fitting that you are the first male contestant.
This is a game show now?
Contestant's not the right word, but...
No. I think guest. That
you were the first male guest. It had to be you.
Did it?
It had to be you.
Why is that?
I don't know. I'm going to break into song. Just kidding.
Don't do
that. No, I won't. No, I won't do that. No, I mean, I feel like you're always putting me on the spot, and now it's my turn to get to put you on the spot a little bit and share a little bit about your story, because you have a good one.
Yeah.
You have a really good one, Scarborough. So we have been married now for...
Depends on who you ask.
I sometimes forget.
Whitney often forgets and tells people we've been married for 20 plus years. I'm sure it feels that long.
I don't know. I do just have to do the mental math. So this December will be 14 years.
This is our 14th anniversary.
Yes, it will be our 14th year of marriage. I think like a year ago, I said we had celebrated 14 years and you were like...
I called your bluff in front of a crowd of people.
And I was like, wait a second. We had to sit there and like actually subtract the years. But so we have been married now for some time, a little bit of time.
Yeah.
Not as long as, you know, everybody, but more than some people.
If... our marriage were a person, we would be a teenager.
Freshman in high school.
Yeah. So still awkward, but, you know, not new kid on the block.
Yeah, about to get their permit.
Oh, geez.
A little bit more independence, moving out of the house in the next couple years.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. Okay, so for those who don't know you, we grew up in somewhat similar backgrounds. And on paper, we both have families who have worked in ministry. You know, we both grew up going to church. We learned about the Bible from an early age. But the actual working out of our faith was very different. So let's talk a little bit about your faith journey and how God led you to a place that you are today.
Okay. Well, the first thing I ever did wrong, is that where I start?
Your first remembered sin.
My first sin.
Not a confession.
Okay. I had this thought that, you know, that scene from, I'm blanking on it. The kid Chunk.
Goonies?
From the Goonies, yeah. And how he had to, like, name all of the things that he did, and he started... He thought whenever he was getting kidnapped by those goons that they wanted him to name everything he ever did wrong. So he started from whenever he was like in fourth grade and worked all the way through. So
yeah,
that's not what this is.
Go. Yeah, your turn.
Okay.
No.
No, I remember growing up in a Christian family with parents who were really involved in our church. I grew up in Austin. And my parents were kind of pillars in our community and in our church. And my parents had always been involved in ministry, whether it was full-time or kind of part-time vocational ministry. They always had their hand in something going on with the church. My dad was often like the MC at our church functions, and they were both in the choir, and they did some counseling through our church, and then probably about whenever I was in high school, they joined a ministry full time called Freedom in Christ, But yeah, so we were always around the church. I went to a church called Grace Covenant. It's still thriving in Central Austin, and it was a great church to grow up in, and it kind of grew up around us. My parents started going to this church whenever they were, I think, fresh out of college, and they were, at the time, they were meeting in an old, like an old Ford dealership. Hmm. And so my parents had seen this church grow from nothing into, kind of the mega church in Austin that it is now. But, yeah, so all of my siblings, I'm the third of four, and we were all, kind of church rats. I mean, like we spent our time up at church with all of the church people, and that was our community, and those were our friend groups, and so I was just always around it. And similar to kind of how our kids are now, I mean, they know all the kind of churchies, and they know like the right things to say and the wrong things to say, and that's similar to how my siblings and I grew up. So I remember whenever I was, I think probably Opie's age now, around five, I remember sitting in church and they were passing the communion plate. And our church does the little, or they did the little, you know, wafers and then like the tiny little, shot glass cups for communion. Mm-hmm. And I remember it's not just grape juice.
Yeah.
I remember the plate kind of passing in front of me, and I went to grab one, and my dad kind of stopped me, and he passed the plate over me, not in a rude way, but he just kind of passed the plate over me. And then once it was, you know, past our row, he kind of leaned down and said, you know, that is the Lord's Supper, and that's what we're about to celebrate as a church, is the Lord's Supper. And he kind of defined that for me, and he said, once you have chosen to become part of the Lord's family, then you can partake in the Lord's Supper. And so I said the prayer right there with my dad in the pew, and I think now, looking back, I probably just did it because I wanted some grape juice. So that set me...
this is all I have to do?
That one grape juice decision set me on a, you know, a course for the rest of my life. So had I known that, I might have chosen differently, but I didn't. So, yeah. But I prayed and received the Lord right there in church with my dad whenever I was about 5 years old. And, you know, I didn't know what that meant necessarily, but over the course of my childhood, it became more and more apparent what I had decided to do. But it was always kind of my parents' faith for the mm-hmm. most part. Like it wasn't something that really became my own until I was probably in high school or college. So, and I know you have more questions, so I don't want to, mm-hmm. I don't want to necessarily keep going, but.
Well, fast forward a little bit to middle school, to seventh grade, when you go on a church retreat.
Yeah. So this was it wasn't even through my church. It was actually through, it might have been through my parents, the organization that my parents ended up working with, Freedom of Christ, but it was kind of a children's ministry version of what they were doing. And I remember my best friend Brian Alley and I went on this retreat. It was in San Marcos, Texas, which is just south of Austin. And I remember going and just, how old are you in seventh grade? Like 12, 13. Mm-hmm. So, I remember sitting in these, it was just like a Friday through a Sunday. And I remember sitting in these, seminar sermon classes, whatever, with kids my own age, like middle school age. And, just them talking about ministry and them talking about what it looks like to actually follow the Lord. And then at the very end of the weekend, there was a lot of activities mm-hmm. similar to anything you do for middle schoolers. Like there was a bunch of activities and games and all this different stuff. But I remember it felt different than like any other retreat like that I had been on. And then I remember at the end of this retreat on Sunday, they had some sort of like altar call, but it wasn't really an altar call. It wasn't like a come confess your sins. I don't remember the phrasing, but they said, if you feel like you are being called into ministry, would you just come to the front and let us pray with you? And I just remember there was no reason why, like, no I hadn't girl. Had a, no.
You weren't trying to impress them.
There was no girl. I had had no conversation with anybody about it. It wasn't like peer pressure. There were only a handful of kids that even went up, and there were probably like over 100 of us there. Hmm. And I just remember sitting in like almost in the back row of this church and just like feeling physically pulled from my heart forward to the front of the church to just get prayed for. And so that I had always had since seventh grade, I always had that in the back of my mind, I feel called into ministry. I feel like I'm supposed to do something in ministry. And it wasn't anything that was of my own fruition or anything like that. It was, I could definitely say now looking back that was, probably the first time that the Holy Spirit kind of like literally tugged on my life and my heart in a real way.
So that's seventh grade. So you're about how old we are in marriage years at that time.
Yes, exactly.
And then you're about to be in high school. And so that was kind of the beginning of you kind of beginning to start to kind of live two different lives. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, starting in high school, it was probably my sophomore year was the first time I ever really got in trouble for, like hanging out with the wrong crowd, hanging out with the rough kids. Drugs and alcohol became a part of my life at that point. And so I got really, really good at living both lives. And I could, because I had grown up in the church, I knew all the right things to say at Sunday school. And I knew all the right things to get away with certain stuff. But then whenever I was at school and on the weekends, come Friday night, you know, after Friday night lights in high school, you know, after the football game, we'd all go out and I was a different kid. And I was making these mistakes and doing these things with other kids from my youth group. You know, it wasn't like I was, you know, it was two different crowds necessarily. It was some of the same kids that were in our youth group, and I was kind of dragging them down with me. And I was, in some respects, I was the ringleader. And so, you know, they were just doing what I was doing. But yeah, I got really good at kind of the two-faced life and trying to hide it from my parents. But I think they knew, you know, they knew what was going on because they had made some of the same mistakes. And so, that kind of trend continued into college. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that didn't help, I would say, was, all of my siblings by this point were making similar decisions. And so, my older sister and my older brother, you know, I wanted to be just like them, and they were doing the same things. And once one of us got caught, kind of early on in our youth, we kind of made a sibling pact in a way of, we all kind of looked each other in the face and said, hey, I won't snitch on you if you don't snitch on me, and we'll all cover for each other. And so we did. I mean, a lot of us, for a lot of the things that we did, we would, you know, we would cover for each other and lie for each other and, you know, give each other alibis and all the things to, so that we weren't getting each other in trouble, and we really never snitched on each other. So that kind of compounded a lot of those things because I had three little allies in my own home that were
kind of aided in your like, yeah. deception.
And I did the same thing for them.
Right.
So yeah, it was a not, I mean, sweet in the sense that, you know, that's like, it's cool to see siblings,
not try to rat each other, like yeah. throw each other under the bus.
Yeah. There's a loyalty there, a loyalty. Right?
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
That's redeeming in a mm-hmm. way. But what we were being loyal about was not redeeming whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that, like I said, that trend kind of continued into college, and, I went to Texas A&M and, was in the Corps of Cadets, and which is, the Corps of Cadets is really just like a glorified militarized fraternity is all it is. At least for me, there are some guys that get, you know, service, duty, responsibility out of it. For me, it was a glorified militarized fraternity because I wasn't going into the military afterwards, and I knew that. And so, I started, drinking pretty heavily in college. I kind of stopped any drug use really in college. I didn't smoke weed anymore or do any of that stuff, but, I did just drink a lot. And, you know, your freshman and sophomore year, especially in the Corps, you don't have a ton of time. And so, I wouldn't say it didn't get bad until probably my junior or senior year. But then by that time I was like, you know, Northgate is the bar district in College Station. And I was just there all the time. You know, I would find a way to drink or go out with, you know, different groups of friends, like 4 or 5, 6 days a week. And, you know, drinking with a purpose type thing. So,
and this is also like the season of life where camp comes into the picture, yeah, too.
Exactly. So, that first summer of college, my brother had worked at a camp in Colorado called Camp Timberline. And, by the time I was a freshman in college, he took me with him to go back to his second year. And, I just fell in love with it. I knew immediately whenever I got there and started experiencing it, that it was exactly what I wanted to do with my career. Like, up until that point, I thought maybe I wanted to be a high school football coach or, you know, something along those lines. But, whenever I experienced summer camp, I was like, this is what I want to do. 'Cause it scratched so many itches, and just skills and talents that I had that kind of came alive and were naturally usable, relevant in a camp setting. So I just came alive at Camp Timberline. And so I spent I was a super senior in college twice. So that means I took 2 victory laps. So for all you doctors out there, I probably went to school about as long as you did, but I don't have a doctorate to prove it. So
just the college loan,
just the loans. Yeah. So because of that, I spent 6 years in college, but I spent I had 5 summers between all 6 of those years. And I spent all 5 of those at Camp Timberline. So I was at Camp T every summer. and I just loved it. And so I spent 3 years as a counselor, just like in a cabin with kids, and then 2 years on leadership, which meant I was supervising the counselors and running the program, and was an actual director of a summer director for Camp T. And I fell in love with it. But I was, just like I did in high school, I was different in the summers than I was the other 9 months out of the year. And so I would go to Camp Timberline and have this amazing experience every summer. And then I would come home and inevitably start making all the same decisions and run them with the same guys and doing the same dumb stuff that I had been, just kind of, Jekyll and Hyde situation, where I hadn't found a good way to make it sustainable. And I knew that the Tim Scarborough at Camp Timberline was the person that I wanted to be, not the Tim Scarborough at Northgate. But I, for whatever reason, it just never stuck throughout the year. And so, I struggled with that all through high school and then all through college. So like a decade of my life, that constant back and forth, Jekyll and Hyde, wearing two different hats, and I could really be a chameleon and blend in with whatever scenario I was in. If I was in a Christian community, I could blend in perfectly, and same thing with the party crowd.
So what happened?
So that all came to a head. My second senior year, I think it was. Yeah, my second senior year. I was at a Cory Morrow concert at the Texas Hall of Fame in College Station, which is just a country music hall. And I was there with my roommate, and we tore the place down. We had a great night, and then come to the end of the concert, it's like 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, and neither of us had any business driving, but I was less drunk. And so I decided to drive, and on the way home, we got pulled over, and we were like less than 100 yards from being back at our house that we were renting. And I just remember being so ticked, like, how is this happening right now? But I spent the night in the clink, and my roommate that was in the car with me, he bailed me out the following morning, and spent that next semester going through all the, jumping through all the legal hoops to take care of that. And I pled. Whenever I stood before a judge, I didn't fight it. I just pled no contest. And I said, just took whatever sentence he had for me. And it included lots of community service. It included like $8,000 to $10,000 in fines. It included, Mothers Against Drunk Driving classes that I had to take, and defensive driving classes that I had to take, and all this different stuff that you kind of have to jump through the hoops. And so I did that for that next year, just kind of taking care of all the, the fallout from a ticket like that. And that was kind of a wake-up call for me, where I realized I had this thing that I thought was just like this activity that you did in college of like drinking and binge drinking and doing it 5-6 nights a week. I thought it was just this innocent college thing that you do, right? It's just like the life of the party, and that's it. But it, at that point, but at that point, it had real life, like very serious ramifications. And I'm like, looking back, I'm just glad I didn't hurt anybody, myself or my roommate or somebody else on the road. But even so, it still had significant ramifications for me. And some of those I still deal with now, however long. I mean, it's been, that was in 2005. So it's been 16, 17 years now. And I'm still, there are still ramifications for that, that I have to explain on background checks or job interviews or all sorts of stuff. So yeah, it just became very real at that point. And that was right around the same time that we met.
Dun, dun, dun.
It was that same year.
The next year.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Then you met me.
Then I met you.
And I had a similar background, but I really was like a goody goody.
Yeah. Compared to me, you really were.
So, it's interesting to think about the timing of all that. So how do you think that, just going back to the DWI, because it was a DWI and it was a, like you said, it was a big deal. It had major ramifications for you. And at the time you were angry, but how do you view that now?
I view that whole experience as probably the thing that ended up saving me. It was the thing that saved my life, because it was a wake up call. It was exactly what I needed to kind of get my attention. The Lord used it to get my attention. To say, like, this lifestyle that you're living right now, you know, it's not sustainable. You know, it's not what I called you to all those years ago. And yet you're still doing it. And I think what I realized then was that seventh grade experience that I had, where I kind of declared, like, I feel called into ministry, because I always had that in the back of my mind and in my back pocket. I felt like I had to, if I was going to spend the rest of my life in ministry, I felt like I had to get it all out of my system. Hmm. Like, I needed to party now while I could, while it was still seen as, you know, socially acceptable in college. I needed to get it all out of my system now, because if I'm going to be, you know, tied to a church for the rest of my life, then I want to get this out of my system. And so I saw it as like this excuse, like making an excuse for doing it at that period of my life. Because I knew once I had a family and a ministry job and all those things, that wasn't going to be part of my life anymore. And so I kind of knew at some point I was going to be kissing it goodbye. And not that it's anything to kiss goodbye, because it's a horrible lifestyle, but that was the rationalization that I gave it in my head.
So how did I come into the picture, and how did I tie into all this?
So you were, like I said, I met you that next year. Mm-hmm. And what I realized when I met you was that you liked me, but you liked the summer camp, Camp Timberline version of Tim Scarborough,
right?
Not the Northgate version of Tim Scarborough. And
the party hard
kid. The party hard kid was not even on your radar.
No.
And
I did not even know that.
Had you, I think had you known me at Northgate, you would not have been into me at all.
Yeah.
And I knew that in the back of my head as well. And so, here I was, this, you know, this amazing Christian girl that actually liked me for who I wanted to be, the Tim that I wanted to be. And so I knew that I had to, make some permanent changes in my life to keep the girl. So I did.
And then I was like, I'm moving overseas.
Yeah.
I'm going into missions.
Yeah.
And apparently that was the one thing that you were like, I'm not doing that.
Right. So even though I had had this calling, like felt this calling in my life to be in ministry, one of the
stipulations
I've gave God, which I realized later that you just don't do. but one of the ultimatums I gave God was, God, I'll do whatever in ministry as long as it's not overseas ministry. Like, you can do, I'll do whatever you want in the U.S., but I just don't want to be an overseas missionary. And then we start dating, and
I'm like, I feel within, like I was calling you overseas.
Within 6 months of us being together, you're pursuing this overseas adventure, and I reluctantly encouraged you to do it, thinking like, oh, she's just going to go get it out of her system, and then, you know, we can do something else. And that just wasn't how it panned out. Because at the same time that you were feeling called to go overseas, I was an intern at a Young Life camp in Georgia called Sharp Top Cove. And as an intern, they gave us all the opportunity to go to a Young Life camp in the Dominican Republic, and called Pico Escondido. And at first, whenever they presented the interns with this possibility or opportunity, I was not interested at all because, again, I had nothing. I had zero interest in overseas ministry. And so I just said no. And then the day came for everybody that was interested in going on this ministry trip, this overseas trip to the Dominican. There was a meeting happening in the dining hall. And I wasn't going because I knew I wasn't interested. I wasn't going to the meeting. But as I was walking past the dining hall, I heard an audible voice that said, go. And I turned around because I thought somebody was talking to me. But I was totally by myself. And so I checked just to make sure that nobody else was with me because I could have sworn that somebody just talked to me. But I kept walking, and then the voice said it again, go. And so I felt like I should probably be obedient and go into this meeting.
I forgot that story. That's crazy.
And so I went into this meeting and ended up going on this trip to the Dominican Republic. And while I was on that trip, it was that same sense that I had in seventh grade whenever I, you know, walked to the front of that church, where I just felt the Lord kind of pulling me in that direction. And again, I was kind of frustrated at the Lord, like, God, I thought I told you, like, I don't want to do overseas ministry. I don't want to do the overseas thing. I want to do something else. And that wasn't what he had in mind. And so the more I softened to the idea, and you were already softening to the idea, because by that point, you had already moved overseas, and you were in a different country, in Bolivia. And so God was softening my heart towards overseas ministry at the same time that you were already moving in that direction.
That's crazy.
Isn't that weird?
It is crazy to think about. So let's just, I have more things I want to like ask related to that, but how would you encourage somebody who is raising kids in the church and they are maybe making really poor choices right now?
Come to our life group. Because we're just winging it, man. We are just a bunch of people that are just doing our best through life in whatever resources we have available to us. And a lot of that is human resources in the terms of community. Like, just surrounding yourself by other people who are headed in the same direction as you. Because you will get whatever results you're pursuing. So if you're pursuing the bottom of a bottle, you'll find it every time without fail. If you're pursuing a joint, you'll find it every time. If you're pursuing, you know, whatever the fix is, if you're pursuing Facebook, it'll be there every single time, you know? But if you're pursuing the Lord, especially if you're doing that in community with others, you'll get that too. Like, you'll find it.
Yeah.
And it's way more powerful when you find it with others than if you try and do it by yourself. Mm-hmm. So I think for parents who are struggling or making poor decisions, find yourself a life group, find yourself a community of believers that will hold your feet to the fire whenever you're making those poor decisions and mm-hmm. pick you up and bring you the other direction.
What about just in terms of, you have parents who feel like, man, did I fail because my kids are totally walking away from the Lord? How would you speak to them? Because I don't think that you think that about your parents at all. And yet you've talked about how each of your siblings were making some similar choices at that time. And so how would you just even encourage a parent who, you know, is beating themselves up, feels like, my kid, you know, I thought I did a really good job, and I thought I equipped them and I taught them well, and they, you know better than this, or, you know, quote unquote, whatever the phrase would be that they would say.
Yeah.
What words of just encouragement and grace would you have for them?
The child's behavior cannot be an indicator of effective parenting necessarily, because it wasn't for my parents. You know, I was making those stupid decisions because I was surrounding myself by kids that that were pursuing those same things. And so but all along, my parents kept on me, and they, you know, I had lots of consequences, especially in high school, of losing privileges and being grounded and, you know, all sorts of stuff. Yeah. I lost my car keys so many times just because my parents knew what was going on. And so they were very consistent, I would say. And then, you know, there came a point where they knew that they had to, regardless of if I was making the right decisions or not, they knew that they had to loosen the reins, because it's the natural way of things. They knew that I was, especially by the time I was 17, 18, that I was about to leave the house, and they could either clamp down until I left, and then I would be, you know, this free bird and probably make even worse decisions, or they could start to give me some freedom before I left. And that's how it kind of went with my parents, is, you know, they didn't come, you know, relieve me of my responsibility in all of it.
They didn't rescue you.
No, they gave me my responsibility, and when I made the horrible decisions, they were there to coach me through it. And they, you know, they never said like, "I told you so" or anything like that. They were there to, you know, love me through it. So, I think just being consistent and, but then also not saving your kids from destructive behavior, you know, you can limit it and you can put some guardrails around it, but you're never going to be able to completely relieve them of all the hard choices that they're going to be faced with. So
your dad, I know, was really instrumental in all this. I remember you telling me that you called him, I think, the day after I don't know if you were still in jail or when you called him, but you kind of told him, and I can't remember exactly what he said, but what was your phone conversation like with him when you called him and just told him that you had gotten arrested, you had spent the night in jail?
I remember him saying things like, "Well, this is going to suck."
Yeah.
You know, like, this is just the beginning kind of thing. And he also had some open-ended questions for me, you know, like, was it worth it? You know, and there was never anything that ruffled Tom Scarborough's feathers. Yeah. Like, the man was unflappable. I never saw him, you know, yell or anything like that. He was just so even keeled, like, to a fault. And so he wasn't like, whenever I called him and told him, it's not like he was surprised. Like, it didn't catch him off guard.
Yeah.
I think he knew what the type of decisions I was making in college.
Yeah.
So, he wasn't surprised by it, but, he also didn't like offer to pay the bills for me, you know?
Yeah.
He said, you might have to get another job.
Yeah.
You might have to, you're going to have to figure out how to still be a full-time student and now also pay for $10,000 of court fees and fees to the county and all these things. So, he was like a proponent of tough love for sure in through all of that. So, yeah.
When I first met your dad, he was in the hospital. I think it was heart surgery. He was about to have heart surgery. And let's just talk a little bit about him and just your journey with him and shift gears a little bit.
Yeah. Tom Scarborough was he was a force of nature. He was someone that always made people laugh. He was oftentimes the center of attention in whatever room he was in. And I think he liked that. Like, he liked being the center of attention because he was a storyteller, and he would tell stories and people were drawn to that. And so, yeah, he was larger than life in a lot of ways. He was very entrepreneurial. He was a restaurateur and a craftsman. And he started a lot of businesses and was just a very creative guy. He could sing like a lark. And so that's where I get my pipes from him. And I think all of my charm and humor and timing I get from Tom Scarborough, mm-hmm. for sure. So, yeah, he was a big old berm of a man. And, yeah, just kind of a teddy bear in a lot of ways. But he was also never, he was never in a hurry. Mm-hmm. Like, you couldn't hurry Tom Scarborough. Because he was, he never owned a watch. I take that back. He did have a, like a pocket watch, not like a wristwatch, but like a pocket watch on a chain.
Like old school.
Yeah. But I think he broke it. So,
so it's just more for looks.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah.
So he just passed away. Oh, it's been almost 3 years now. This yeah. fall, right?
Yeah, September 21st will be 3 years.
Wow, so...
Is that right? 3 years or 4 years?
3 years, I think. Oh. Yeah. So he, as long as I ever knew him, he was sick and dealing with sickness. And so rather than get into all the nitty-gritty of, you know, the details of his sickness, I just would love to talk about just what it was like to lose a parent fairly early in life and to watch your parent suffer and his health decline, and just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I dealt with in my 30s what most adults deal with in their, you know, 50s or 60s of having to bury a parent. And so it wasn't surprising necessarily, because we all kind of saw it coming. He had some chronic health issues that led to his kind of decline, and so it didn't catch anybody by surprise, you know. It wasn't like a cancer or something like that. It was a decade of slow decline. And so but I think it does cause you to just think about the finality of life and what it all is and means and what's it for. And so, you know, I found myself asking those questions earlier than a lot of my peers because of what I experienced with my dad. So, yeah, but death is an ugly thing. Like, it is not pretty, and it's not, there's nothing about it that is, it's easy to watch for sure. Especially when it's slow like that. So it's a, because of that though, it's good at offering perspective, because you realize what's important pretty quick, whenever you watch somebody go through something like that. So, yeah.
How do you honor your dad's memory and your dad's legacy now in your day-to-day?
Man, right now, it feels like I'm honoring it a lot, because I'm a contractor right now. And so my dad was a contractor for a big chunk of his career. He was a general contractor, probably, I don't know, 15 to 20 years of his life he spent as a general contractor in Austin. And, you know, he was really good at it. Never had a huge company, but was, he had a client base that was, in Austin that was really loyal. And, you know, he did really quality work and was known as like the honest, trusted contractor. And, you know, he's someone that you could trust on a job site. And so, I think he earned a reputation as that guy. And so I feel like, that's kind of my speed a little bit too, like, in terms of the pace of my life right now and the kind of jobs that I'm taking on as a contractor, I feel like are jobs that would be honoring to him. And just, the craftsmanship side of it, I guess,
attention to detail.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Attention to detail and putting in a hard day's work. And, my working on my dad's job sites was the first job I ever had. Whenever I was about 10 years old, I remember cleaning up on his job sites, and he would pay me $1 an hour, to do whatever. And it was probably just throwing money at me.
A whopping $1 an hour.
Yeah. 'Cause my mom didn't want me in the house. So I got sent to the job site, but, that was my first job. And so, I think he taught me work ethic. And so I think right now I'm honoring that and just his entrepreneurial side as well, you know, starting and running a successful business in a big city like Austin. I think what I'm doing now is honoring that as well. But I also think that, you know, if you asked him, he probably wouldn't make much of his career as he would make of his vocation, you know, which I think he would say that his vocation was more in ministry and family ministry. And, you know, he would always say that your family has to be your first ministry. Your wife has to be your first ministry. I think having a healthy family and a family that, you know, we're involved in our community and in our church and, raising kids that love the Lord and in a marriage that honors God. I think all of those things at the same time honor Tom Scarborough and his legacy, you know, 'cause those are the way he trained us up to be, you know, he raised us in that same way. So, yeah.
That's good. How would you encourage somebody who's watching a parent or a family member suffer and their health steadily decline?
To remember the good parts and recall those on a regular basis. I think one of the things that that we did whenever my dad passed was we had a celebration of life instead of a funeral. We opted for kind of a celebration of who he was. And I feel like there's a way to do that while your loved ones are still with you. You know, you can do that in a way that honors them while they're still living. And, I would say to spend time with them as much as possible and just honor them and celebrate them in authentic ways.
That's good. I feel like there's still a lot we could talk about. I feel like this is just the first of many visits you'll be on the podcast.
We could talk or not talk for hours.
Name that movie. You've been a very good contestant.
Oh, thank you. Did I win?
We'll be back in just a minute after a word from our sponsor.
Welcome to another episode of Family Feud. I'm your host, Tim Scarborough.
And I am the...
Victim.
Victim. Named Whitney Scarborough.
Well, I hear you had an amazing guest on your podcast this week.
Yes, I did. You mean contestant?
Yes, contestant.
I did. Wow. He was very handsome. You should be very jealous.
Most attractive guest so far?
Yes, most handsome by far.
That's amazing.
Most bearded.
Well, this is a big deal because this is your first double-digit podcast.
Oh, it is.
It's number 10.
That's exciting.
Big time.
That's exciting.
Yeah. And
that is fun. And thank you for people who have been listening. It's so fun to hear little... just encouragements and feedback and thoughts and texts and calls, just different things to know that you've listened, you've been encouraged, you've been blessed by it, or you disagree with us.
Or you think we're full of crap. Mostly just me.
Yes, just you.
Well, real talk, we have had a week in the Scarborough compound.
Things have been... a little touch and go around here.
Yeah.
We don't need to give all the details because people don't need to know exactly when we recorded this. But let's just say that within the past week, three of our family members are COVID positive and maybe have other bugs. We know at least one child has strep.
Yeah, we're just having a banner week.
Yeah, neither of us currently can really taste.
No.
I can't tell if I'm eating, like, pepperoni pizza or, like, a smoothie. Like, it's like... I mean, I can tell textures, but it's just weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's strange.
It's... yeah. And we're joking, but honestly...
we're having a hard enough time keeping ourselves alive, much less our kids.
Well, it's just... we have, you know... I feel like a week ago, actually, yes, a week ago, we had like a day that was like total perfection. One of those rare days when the kids are getting along and you just, life is good. You love your spouse, you love your kids, everything just works and it's, I mean, you're just like on all cylinders, you know, it's just a perfect day. It happens rarely. And then like throw in a couple of fevers and like congestion and some COVID scares in there and we're like falling apart. It's like, it is, I mean, we don't like each other. We've been like, we've been fighting most days this week.
Is that one of the side effects of COVID? Is that you fight with your spouse? I think it is. It, clinically, like it's part of it.
Definitely if you both have it, right? Oh my gosh. It's been rough.
We're going to make
it. So full disclosure. Yeah, we're going to make it.
There's light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, and honestly, thankfully, it has been mild. And I know it's not that mild for many people. We've had very mild cases. So we're thankful and we're not making light of it for those of you who have struggled with it. But know that we have not been our kindest selves over here.
We're in it right now. In the thick of it. All right, your question this week is... if you won the lottery tomorrow, what would you spend the money on?
Oh my goodness. Okay, well, it depends on the amount.
Okay.
Because
let's say the lottery is for $465 million.
Oh my gosh, that's an insane amount of money.
That's what a lot of them are these days.
Really?
Yeah.
You act like you're like so they're, familiar.
They're like in the hundreds of millions.
Really?
I'm not a lottery player, but I see the billboards like every the once in a while. Basic
things like pay off our house. I would pour some money into that guest house that we haven't finished.
Wait, are you? So you're a lump sum person, not a pay it out over a 20, 30 year period?
Oh yeah, I've heard about that. You can
because you have to choose.
You have to decide. I'd have to consult with a financial analyst on that one, but...
they just take all your money.
They just say, let me see that. And I mean, the whole payout over how many years can you decide to do it?
I don't really know, but I've heard like 20 or 30 years.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Wow. I like that idea too. Well, no, I would probably take it all and I would say, yeah, pay off the house, put money into that guest house, finish it. And we're so close to being done with our bathroom.
So then you'd still have $465 million left. Because all of that stuff is less than like a couple hundred thousand.
That's true. That's true. So, well, people listening might think we have a really nice house.
Yeah. Super not.
I love our house.
I do too.
Yeah.
What would you do with literally all the rest?
Okay, for real, I would take most of it and invest it. Again, financial analyst, right? Like, invest it strategically, right? I would set up some better college funds going, because that could, like, I mean,
you could buy a college.
We could buy a college. They would be fine. They would be set. You're right. But I mean, as far as like fun things, I think I would say beach house. I know you're going to say no to that. So I've already decided we'll compromise and go for lake house that has some mountains in the vicinity. That would be sweet. And get a boat. But for real, I think we would have to just pause life and do some travel. You know? I mean, the COVID situation, though, is still a situation, though. You know, that does hamper travel internationally right now. It does affect it. But let's say that, I mean, I just won the lottery, so we could probably have enough money to actually cure COVID, so.
Doubt it.
No, so, but for real, if we're living this alternate universe where this is happening, I would say we definitely do some travel. That would be something, you know, something that we'd have to do fun. We'd go this winter, go take our kids skiing, teach them how to ski. But I think I'm such a saver. I'd be so excited about just like saving it and watching it grow. Seriously. And being like, we're only going to spend like $100,000 and the rest is going in the bank. Seriously.
That would be no fun.
Whatever. Because then in like a year, all of a sudden we'd have like, I don't know how interest works on those things, but we'd have a lot of money in a year.
At least $1 billion.
No, that's an exaggeration.
Yeah, it is. Okay. Well, I mean, a third of it's going to go to taxes anyway, so.
That's true. Man, wet blanket. Thanks a lot.
Yep, no problem. Okay, so once you're done spending all your money, if you won the lottery, how would your life change? That's the deeper question. How would your life change if you won the lottery?
Would there be an option of winning anonymously? That would be so fun if you won anonymously and then you could just like gift people who needed money.
Actually, there was somebody that just
big chunks of money
recently did that.
They won it anonymously
and told no one. Yeah.
I feel like you could do that 100%. Mister, you found out the gender of our children and didn't tell me. I feel like you could definitely win it anonymously. I feel like that'd be really hard.
What makes you think I haven't already?
Oh my gosh.
I've just been sitting on $465 million.
How much interest have we already built?
Many.
Many.
Many much.
Many much interest.
Yep.
I think life would change though. Like if people knew. I don't know. I
mean, would it make people would come out of the woodworks.
Would it make you like a celebrity to some extent?
No. Because I don't know any lottery winners.
That's true. Yeah, except for that old movie, It Could Happen to You. What was it called? Remember that movie?
No.
It was, what's his name? It's Nicolas Cage. He's in it. And he like, it's at, I think it is. It's called like, It Could Happen to You or something. I just saw it on like the picture of it on the screen. And he goes into a diner and he says something like, if I win the lottery, I'll give you a piece of it or something like that. Do you remember that movie?
Sure don't.
Okay. You are no help right now. Okay, that's all we got.
Well, we'll let you guys know if we win the lottery. Thanks for joining
us.
We
won't.
We'll see you next time.
To find show notes for this and past episodes, or to engage on a deeper level, you can go to wovenministry.com/podcast. If you enjoy what you hear so far, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps listeners find and share this feed. If you'd like to tell us what you enjoyed about this podcast or ask your hard question, you can call us at 512-815-2446. That's 512-815-2446. You'll simply leave a voicemail with what's on your mind, and we might just include your voice on a future episode. Music and editing for the show is by Callan Brown. Recording and production by Tim Scarborough. I'm Whitney Scarborough, and we'll be back here with more very soon. Thanks for listening.